Okay, today, first of all, is Sunday, April 3rd. We all survived April Fool's Day, and today is Sunday, April 3rd, 2016. It is a beautiful week in Yerushalayim. The weather is what we all dream about here, and this weather can continue like this. Those of you who have lived here know April, May, into June, we can have this magnificent weather. All those listening in Chutz Laretz, if you want to visit Israel, this is the best time of the year to visit. April into May into early June, you're going to have magnificent weather. I want to dedicate today's shiur in memory of Reb Meir Halevi Soloveitchik. The Brisker world suffered a big loss. Reb Meir Halevi, there's now only one surviving child of the Brisker Rebbe, Reb Velvel. That's Reb Meshulam David Soloveitchik, who heads up one of the Brisker Yeshiva Kolelim. Reb Meir Halevi was also involved in Hapatzat HaTorah. The most famous one of the Brisker today is Reb Avram Yeshua Soloveitchik, who's a son of the eldest child of Reb Velvel, Reb Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. He died quite young, I remember in the early 80s, and when he died, my phone just stopped ringing because the word went out that Reb Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik died. So I called Tova Lich, I told Dr. Tova Lichtenstein immediately, and she told me, Lo Aleinu, it's not my father, it's my cousin. In other words, Reb Yosef Dov Halevi of Yerushalayim was the Reb's first cousin. And over Shabbos, I believe, I don't know exactly when, but Reb Meir Halevi died, I believe, on Shabbos. And there's now just one more sibling left of the children of Reb Velvel. And the generation moves on, and it behooves us, we have to take it further.
Why is this family so nutty? They just
want to
make every author who's
going to
write a biography nuts.
Well, why nuts? Reb Meir Halevi, it's an easy name. Baruch Hashem, they have after whom to name their children and grandchildren. You can't. No, you can't contest that. Okay, I want to get in. Today I'm going to reveal.
Rabbi Weinberg died about 6 years ago.
Rabbi Weinberg, Charlie Weinberg. Right. Thank you. So
I was right.
I was right. You were right. But Rabbi Rubin, you were wrong. So who were you confusing him with?
There's another Weinberg who was a rabbi in Boston.
No, he was in a suburb, I believe, in Malden, if I'm not mistaken. Right. And what I said was correct, but okay, I'm happy to hear
his
that.
His wife is still alive.
His wife is still alive. All right,
they
live in the plaza.
Right, that's right.
Right, right.
Because they could manipulate. He got them the right to build the hotel there, so they gave it.
Okay, so he was entitled to an apartment. Listen, you know what's going on with Chaver Knesset Aryeh Deri today. So please, don't mention Charlie Weinberg in the same breath with manipulation and Aryeh Deri. Okay. Yitzchak, relax, let me teach you. For those listening, you know, in Chutz Laretz, they don't realize Israel, on one hand, it's very sad, I have to tell you. You know, the way we live, I just spent 3,950 shekel. Would anyone want to guess what I spent it on? My grandson was given permission to get a gun. A number of my grandsons applied, and I told them, whoever has to get a gun, I will help pay for it. All right, this one I paid entirely. So one was turned down. He lives in Jerusalem, even though he goes to Haaretz Ofim almost every day to Bezalel. But he, and even though he was a Chayal Mitztayein and all that goes with it, a Tzanchan, but no, you're not entitled. This other grandson was also very special in the army, but that doesn't entitle you, but he lives in Pisgat Zev Mizrach. In addition, he works in Yehuda Vishomron. In addition, he's going to Ariel University, so he's entitled to get a gun. So on one hand, it's very sad that we have to live this way, and even today already, there were two attempts at stabbings. One lady was lightly injured. Two attempts in two different areas. The way we live. On the other hand, if you watch your government officials, it's better than a Shakespearean play. When I heard last week, what was it, Thursday, the news broke that Ari Dery under investigation and Buzhi Herzog, I said, I can't believe this. Now, Buzhi Herzog is a criminal. He should have gone to jail for what he did about 15 years ago, because his name is Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, the grandson of, he ran a charity fund for widows and orphans, and the money was diverted to Ehud Barak. You remember that? And they found it, and they had it. And the Attorney General, they didn't press charges. So whatever happens now, it's catching up with them. There's a chazal that says what I'm saying. When you fall off a ladder, you know what I'm referring to. So that's on one hand. On the other hand, if Ari Dery, they now turned it into a criminal investigation, if he is guilty, if that man came back again and again, then the only word I can use is a word taught to me by Sempo Sugihara.
How about that Shimon,
for your sake, I don't know how to say it in English, Fadobnkeit. Such a rotten personality, such a scoundrel I haven't seen in my whole life. Got it? Okay, now repeat it in Yiddish. Azafa Dobrinkeit. You understand? Dobrinkeit. You got it. You got it. Alex. Okay. No, yeah, Yiddish. You keep your language. The soldier, I've spoken about it already.
He's
a hero in all my grandchildren's eyes, which is more important than my eyes. Alex Glassman, are you related to the Glassman who dedicated the AACI Center? Have you been to Talpiot? Big Glassman, AACI.
I doubt it.
You doubt it. Go and check. Am I right? It's like you don't have to. Okay. My wife says, is that your student? I said, I have to ask him. All right, you check it out. All right, gentlemen, today is a very serious, interesting shiur. There's no question, Reb Heschel Schechter, and according to Yomo, he's feeling a little bit better, so I'm very, very happy to hear that news, because, you know, when he was here, he was not well, and the Kavela Refuah Shlema. So Reb Heschel Schechter wrote a tshuva, which became classic. Some people love it, some people criticize it, and they're dealing with this tremendous problem of the women who want to make their own prayer group. And last week we went into the whole story with the Rav and Reb Moshe Feinstein and the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rabbi Steve Riskin, and there's no question that it's very hard to find an Issa for women to go into a room and make their own prayer group and have a woman lead the prayers, as long as they're not saying Kaddish and Kedusha. And do you need paper to write on, Yitzchak? Is that what you're looking for? Here. Then give this to Michael Miller, because he'll like the article. It's about Joe Garantiola, what he told me about. But you can write on the other side. And there's no question that it's very hard to find an Issa. And all three, the Rav, Reb Moshe, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, were matir, not happily, but they said, b'di'evit, if the women insist. All right, someone from Lubavitch contacted me and said the reason they're angry at Rabbi Riskin, that everything he said is true, except he claims that when the Rebbe called him to revise his opinion, the Rebbe said to him, you should do it, but don't say that I told you to do it.
Yeah, that's what I
and it seems Riskin says the Rebbe said you should do it. All right, I'm not going to fault Riskin, I'm not going to fault the Lubavitcher Rebbe. We're dealing here with a real difficult life situation. Now, and then Reb Heschel goes on with his beautiful Bekiyot to speak about that even though we can be matter certain things in Halacha, but tradition speaks. And he speaks about giving a child some sort of, you'll have to ask them all what they can do. The child shouldn't cry, maybe they numb the area where they're going to cut. They put powder on it. As you said, you're not going to give a young kid anesthesia, but there are medical ways of doing it. And Rabbi Yehuda Leib Cyrilson of Romania came out with a tshuva permitting it. Now, by the way, I'll have something to give out later, where in this volume on Romanian Jewry, you can find a whole description, a biography of Rabbi Yehuda Leib Cyrilson. He was an Adam Gadol. And even though he permitted it, the Gedolei Yisrael didn't go along with it because it's breaking with tradition. And he goes on and on and gives other examples where Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg and other poskim were ready to be matir certain areas, but they wouldn't go against tradition. So of course, then someone can ask, wait a minute, life doesn't change. And we spoke about this last week. All of us here are wearing very modern clothing. And even though Alex Glassman is wearing a jacket and wearing a hat, but it's not the same hat his great-grandfather wore back in the real white Russian Lubavitch. And they, you know, where can you change? Where can't you change? Shimon is sitting here, Shabbos, he wears normal Western clothes. His great-great-grandfather, where do you descend from? Your Sephardic roots?
Holland.
Holland. So the Rabbanim in Holland dressed differently than the rabbis in Holland dress today. So Rabbi Heschel says, yes, we do make changes, but it's Gedolei Yisrael who have the insight and have the chush, the feeling. They know what we can change, what we can't change. Now, this leads us, and here I'm picking up new material, I'm opening up, you have to go back and hear my lectures. But you see, when you speak like this, you get involved with the whole question of Das Teira. And this is an interesting question. What is the power of rabbis? Is there such a thing as Das Teira? What is Rabbi Heschel referring to? And as I explained many years ago in great depth, I don't believe in Das Teira. I don't believe that concept exists. I showed it to you. It's a Gemara in Chulin, Tzadi Hei. And it deals with tradition, Das Teira, what is considered the Git HaNasher, what can you eat, what can't you eat. And we say Das Teira, tradition has it this way. What I do believe in is Amunat Chachamim. Now, Amunat Chachamim is very clearly defined. It means if someone's going to come along and say, I don't want this psak, that halacha is like Abaya against Rabbah, I want a paskin like Abaya, I want a paskin like Rabbah, I want a paskin like Rabbi Meir, again, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yochanan, Rish Lakish, you're going to turn around all these Gemaras, Emunat Chachamim, this is what our Chachamim have given us, this is Torah Shebaal Peh. And there's no question we have to follow the rabbis. But what do you do beyond that? And here, Das Teira says on every issue the rabbis can pontificate. I use the word pontificate because it's very frightening. It resembles a Catholic concept that the Pope speaks ex cathedra. And we know that the Agudas Yisrael, Labriyot, Agudas Yisrael on one of the most basic issues of modern times was totally wrong. To be an Agudis from 1999, you had to subscribe to the idea that there can be no Jewish sovereignty in the state of Israel before Mashiach Tzidkenu. And today, Agudat Yisrael is as much a part of the state of Israel as the Mizrachiites were dreaming about in 1919. Think for a minute. They're integrated. They serve in the army. They go to university. They're Hasidim. They're part and parcel of the Israeli scene. So much so that when you do a television show, Shtitzel has captivated the mainstream Israeli market. So it shows you there's integration here. Alex, to answer your question, I don't say they're integrated as much as I am and my children and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren.
They have a different ideology about that.
Alex, you're daydreaming. They absolutely say it's Jewish sovereignty. They serve in the Knesset. Litzman is now sovereign of Shalit Yisrael. Do you know when Litzman walks into the room, you have to stand up? Not because he's a Gadol B'Torah.
But they wouldn't say that that's Jewish sovereignty. They'd say it's a secular government.
In 100 years, you will say, Rebbe, you were 99% right.
No, okay? I won't.
In 100 years.
How
do you know it's going to be in 100 years? Because when I go back to 1919 and I see what happened in 2019, it's overwhelming, the change. Now, Alex, you know who doesn't let them forget this? Deborah Kefitz, right? The Eder Charedit. buy yourself a copy of Al HaChoma, and you see what they do to Agudat Yisrael. And when Litzman went in, and would you believe it? No. Who's the most popular Tsar in the state of Israel today? Who has the highest rating, even in North Tel Aviv? Yaakov Litzman, a Lakewood graduate, a Gera Chassid from Borough Park, living in Medina. And they love him. They say he's the greatest thing that happened to the hospital system in Israel. Okay. Anyway, so this is a very delicate question. There's no doubt in my mind when it comes to introducing major changes, we have to be concerned with what Gedolei Israel have to say. And there's no doubt in my mind, and believe me, I have a Rebbe. My Rebbe used to say, I don't have Ruach HaKodesh. No, if the Rebbe said he doesn't have Ruach HaKodesh, believe me, we don't have Ruach HaKodesh. But if I have a question, I go to the Rebbe. I go to Rebbe Aaron Lichtenstein. I live in a world today where I am orphaned, because there are very few people I can speak with who understand me and I understand them. And we have the same understanding of the world around us. But there's no question that Reb Heschel makes a very good point here, that when you're going to innovate, particularly in a synagogue, it has to be with the acquiescence of great Talmidei Chachamim Gedolei Yisrael. Now, then Reb Heschel goes further. And here's where Alex got angry at me on Monday when I quoted this Rambam in relation to Satma. And here the Rav, here Reb Heschel quotes it in relation to innovation in a shul, in a synagogue, in spiritual life. Natan, and this is something that I've said publicly 1,000 times over, and I continue to say it. I am who I am. I come from where I come. My Rebbe Mavuk is Rav Soloveitchik. I don't deny any of this. I have a bachelor's, I have 2 masters, I have a doctorate. I'm not afraid of the big world. I'm thankful to a student for teaching me how to use a computer. I actually was able to paskin a shaila in this very kolel and save a student's life through innovative usage of the computer. When I finished, I said to this Talmud, how come you didn't do what I did with the computer? He said, Rebbe, you had siyata d'shmaya. I said, you're absolutely right. Because I showed him the Netziv's Teret, a tshuva, on publishing Rav Bamberger's Yad HaLevi, where he didn't want it published. Maybe I'm wrong. And the Netziv Paskin absolutely brought 100 proofs that when a Rav Paskin says Shaila lahalacha, he has siyata d'shmaya. So I'm not afraid of all this. But one thing I want to make clear. My davening and my kashrut and my Beit Knesset and my Shabbat and my mikveh has to be very accommodating, so a Gera Chassid, a Belzer Chassid, a Lubavitcher, a Lakewood boy will walk in and feel totally at home. I am not willing to break with the overall Torah world. You can call it Haredi, call it what you wish. We're all part of the same world. My greatest nachat is when I go into the Shtiblach in Meir Sharim or in Zichron Moshe, or even in Katamon, where it's not so pronounced. There's so many different Jews of so many different types, and we're all davening together. Ashrei Yoshvei Beisecha, Kedusha is Kedusha. If we don't say Tachnun, everyone is happy. I just heard a joker quote me quoting me that, what makes a Jew happy? He saves a minute and a half not saying Tachnun, because there's Chvesa, a Yotzeit of the Rebbe on a Tuesday or Wednesday. Monday, Thursday, I can understand, but Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, Sunday, what's the big deal? And I'm not willing to break with the world. Now, Reb Heschel attaches this to the Rambam in Perek Gimel of Hilchat Tshuva, where the Rambam says that one of those who have no share in the world to come are haporish min hatzibur. And Reb Heschel interprets it, haporish min hatzibur is where someone makes changes, and these changes are revolutionary. And Reb Heschel is adamant here. He was criticized. You know, what are you taking a parchment at Zebra, applying it here? but it's something to think about. I'm not willing to go as far and say, "Ein lo chelik halam haba," that this is a porish min atzibo in the full sense of the way the Rambam paskins, but there is a concept here that we have to be concerned with. And you got to remember, porish min atzibo, the Rambam spells it out, even if you do all the mitzvot and you're medantek in everything, but if you're porish min atzibo, you are an apikairis, ein lo chelik liyom haba. It's a very fascinating concept. The message behind it is, we can't be so innovative that 90% of Shomer Shabbos Jews are going to refuse to daven in my shul because of what I'm doing. And this is Reb Heschel's message. Now I want to come to something, a sideshow from Reb Heschel, that you're going to find very funny. And I have to give Heschel credit, that Rav Schechter credit, pardon me. He's Rav Schechter, but to me, what can I tell you? We play together as kids. I have to give Rav Schechter credit that he takes on a mistake, that I saw the mistake, and I figured, what's the difference? It doesn't affect anything. But he corrects it. Now, what are we referring to? The Rav always said, and anyone who has common sense and knows Torah history says the same thing, that you see, when you begin innovating with Judaism, it begins on a very small level, but look what it leads to. And the Rav quoted, what was the first reform? Believe it or not, it may very well be that the first reform was Yekum Pukin, that why do we say it twice? Look into your siddur, you say it twice, Shabbos morning. Once as a yachid, once for the tzibur. Why do we need it twice? Yeah, they got rid of it. Then people said, why do we need it at all? It's Aramaic. They got rid of it altogether. The reforms. We're talking now in the 1820s. And take a look what came out of that revision of Yikum Purkan. So the Rav quoted, and I'm quoting now from the Ikvei Hatzon on page 30 in the footnote. And the Rav quoted, and I heard this with my own ears a number of times, the Rav quoted, and I learned with the Rav many decades, so I heard it from a number of times. Rav Shmuel David Lutzato, Shadal. Are you familiar with the Shadal? Those of you that have studied Tanakh, studied with Nechama Leibowitz, Zichron Tzadikit Levracha, so you know she always used to quote the Shadal. It's from the Lutzato family from Italy, and he was a frum Jew, 100%. On the other hand, he was a modern biblical scholar. He was a very interesting, if you're familiar with the Tanakh put out by Mosad Rav Kook, Da'at Mikra, which is a traditional Tanakh with a perish that is scientific, contemporary. Shadal is quoted quite a number of times. So the Rav quoted from Shadal, where he said a joke, where Shadal quoted the Pasuk, Vayimach et kol hayukum. That when you talk about the flood and everything was wiped out, Vayimach et kol hayakum. And Shadal said a joke. This is what the Reform Movement did. They destroyed all the reference to Yekum Pukan in the davening. Again, what's the pasuk? Vayimach et kol hayakum. And Shadal, that was Shadal's joke. So Reb Heschel says, and this was misunderstood by those who published the Rebbe's writings, Yemei Zikaron. All right, let me pause for a moment and give you a little background here, Natan. Those of you who heard my lectures many decades ago before you were born on Lithuanian Jewry, on Brisk, on Reb Chaim, so Dani, I made the point that Reb Chaim would not publish his Chidushei Torah. He was always worried maybe he was wrong. A perfectionist. This is why all we have from Reb Chaim is a little thin volume, Chidush Rebbeinu Chaim HaLevi al HaRambam, and even that volume, it is not easy to comprehend because they played with every sentence. As Rabbi Yochanan Gerelik told me, they over-edited it. The Rav inherited this trait.
I heard that he had a whole room
storm
that the Nazis got rid of.
Rav Velbel inherited from his father. Rav Chaim died in World War I, but it has to be Rav Velbel inherited from his father. No, of course, what they was left behind in Europe, of course. So the Rav inherited this trait. The Rav did not publish one syllable in Halacha, basically, during his lifetime. He published a little bit, his father published in the 1930s, to let people know in America that the Rav is not an Amaretz. But very little. There was no Sefer. By the 1970s, the world was going crazy, pleading with the Rav to publish. Guys like a guy named Rabbi Yitzchak Rubin wrote a letter to the Rav, rebuking the Rav for not publishing his talks on Parshat HaShavua. So the Rav weakened a little bit in his old age, and he found in the Jewish agency, the head of the Torah Culture Department, which no longer exists, was a Pelish Yid named Moshe Krona. Now, I knew Moshe Krona very well, and we owe the fact that we're sitting here in this building is due to a certain degree to Reb Moshe Krona, who came up with BMT and Rakefet and all that goes with it, and Mr. Gris. So the Rav liked Reb Moshe Krona. He was a very intelligent Jew, a Pelish Yid, and he could read the Rav's handwriting. So the Rav gave him many drusha that he gave to publish. These were published by the Torah Culture Department of the Jewish Agency, and Yemezi Karom is one of them. If you go to page 174, you'll see he's quoting the Rav, and the Rav says that you have to understand the Rav is talking to a popular audience. This is a tshuva drasha, and he's talking that, yes, we have various levels of importance and observance. The Rav said, they're dinim d'oraita, they're dinim d'rabbanim, they're minhagim. He says, you don't have to tell me, I'm not such an amaretz. I know very well that not eating on Yom Kippur is a lot more important than walking around without a kippah. Okay? But nevertheless, Judaism becomes a total mechanism. And when you break away on one level, it ultimately affects the entire body, the entire gestalt. And the Rav says, yes, Shmuel David Luxato was right. Becholzot Sadak Shmuel David Luxato, who spoke about the German reform movement, that they wiped out the prayer Yom Kippur, and then they wiped out that which is written in the Torah, Vayimach Kol Hayukum. You understand? That's the way he understood the Rav. The Rav said something else. The Rav quoted him, first they knocked out one Yom Kippur, and then they knocked it out completely. Step one, step two, completely out. Rabbi Moshe Krona understood it a little bit differently, that they knock out Yom Kippur and then they knock out Kol HaYikum, the entire Yiddishkeit, the entire structure. So it's fascinating that Rav Heschel took the time to correct Rabbi Moshe Krona in the footnote. Because essentially, there's no difference between what the Rav really said and the way Reb Moshe Krona understood it. What's the difference? The idea is the same. When you start playing with your kumplukun, ultimately you knock out all of Yiddishkeit. But that's Reb Heschel, and he corrects Reb Moshe Krona on page 30. All right. Then he goes even further. And he speaks about how sacred every minhag is in the Beit Knesset. And here he's paraphrasing the Rav. What is a Beit Knesset? A Beit Knesset is a Mikdash Ma'at. Nu, do we play games with the Beit HaMikdash? Are we going to go in and change the structure? Are we going to go in and change the format? A Mikdash Ma'at, you have to shake and stand in fear. And here they're coming to play games with the Beit HaKnesset. And then, and this is the most controversial part, that the women, the feminists, were very, very upset with. He starts paraphrasing Reb Moshe. Reb Moshe in his tshuva, you look in Torah Chaim, the first volume, where Reb Moshe deals with women prayer groups, he accuses them of being part of the feminist movement. Their desires are not l'shem shamayim. They want to be like the feminist movement. And Reb Heschel carries it many steps further. And he gets involved that why aren't we allowed to wear women? You'll see all the sources. I don't spoon feed you, because you can see all the sources in B'Ikvei Chatzon. But tell me, are you allowed to wear a dress? Is a woman allowed to dress like a man? No, where do you find the literature on this? Purim. Purim plays, and women and men, and tremendous literature. But one thing is certain, during the entire year, a man cannot dress like a woman. A woman cannot dress like a man. And how did the Rishonim explain it? Pritzot. You understand, there was once a Hollywood movie, I remember in the 50s with Marilyn Monroe, what was the movie? That men were running away from the mafia, if I recall the plot correctly. I am with it, Shia, right? They were running away from the mafia, and they dressed like women, so the mafia, and they get involved with another woman who happened Jack to be, Lemmon. Jack Lemmon was there? Like all right, what was it called? Some like it hot. I remember the plot, and everyone was talking about it, a movie, and people rushing Saturday night to see the movie, Some Like It Hot. Okay, but Pritzot, all the Rishonim say, sure, when you can dress like a woman, you move among women, I don't have to go any further. Look at that maneuver who set up cameras in the mikvot in Washington, D.C. God have mercy on us when you have perverted sexual minds. Look what's going on today in the news with Moshe Katsav. Also unbelievable. Had a whole discussion with a lawyer earlier today, on this whole concept. If he doesn't express a regret, how can you let him out a third early? And what that means, and I heard a whole discussion on the radio, that as I was driving, Reshet Bet, that it shows disrespect for the court, you're not willing to admit they were right in finding you guilty. All right, there won't be, it seems that it's now moved to Wednesday. They didn't decide today, they're going to reconvene the committee on Wednesday. But it's pritzot. Now I have to tell you, so Reb Heschel was very strongly criticized. This is the way you attack women, this is what you think of women, the women are sincere. All right, there's no question that certainly in the year 2016, 2017, women are sincere. And you have to deal with it. You can't criticize them. You can't be negative. You have to deal with it halachically, emotionally, and you have to deal with it from the point of view of Hashkafa. But Rafi, we have to understand something. These women, as I've said so many times, our women can conquer the world. I have at least two granddaughters-in-law who are going to be getting doctorates, okay? So I know what's going on. I know what's going on in the world. Two or three. I have three.
Isn't that just a riot that it's secular?
But please, let me say what I want to say. I have three granddaughters-in-law. One is an MD already. She's going to be doing her stage at the Laniato. And starting at Laniato, she explained to me how it works here. And I have another one getting a Baruch Hashem, a PhD from Hebrew U in Sun Biology, I believe it is. Another one is getting a PhD, something to do with vision, optical matters, Bar Ilan. Okay, women, these are good women. and they can conquer the world. So then the question comes up, they want Elaine the Megillah, okay? And by the way, I don't have with two out of the three, certainly not just at Elaine the Megillah, but one, Taka was involved, and the Rav there, she paskined exactly what I told you last week, paskined exactly what I paskined. Read it in the private house, Women for Women. It was, by the way, in this week's Makor Rishon, the Friday issue. There's a big article in the Shabbat section on women laying for women, and they interview Rabbi Riskin. So you can't put the motives down. We have to understand they are sincere. And what they're saying is we want to express ourselves. How can we express ourselves halachically to the maximum? They don't have tzad gidul banim anymore. They don't have to churn the milk. They don't have to milk the cow, etc., etc. But I want to say something. As far as the general feminist movement around us, exactly what Reb Heschel said has come to pass. Men are no longer men, women are no longer women. There's a whole concept of unisex. And it relates right down the line. Anything you can think about. I've seen women walking in suits with hats that until you look at them, and see lipstick on them, you think they're men, dressed like men. What have we achieved? Unisex bathrooms, and it goes on and on. What the so-called feminist movement, what they have come to achieve. And I have my own misgivings about the Israeli army, that some of our leaders here are so stupid, they think everything in the Western world has to be aped and followed. I don't believe women should be frontline combat soldiers. There are many reasons why. I think it's obvious, you should understand, if a woman is captured and a man, in addition, a woman simply physically can't do what a man does. And I can prove it 1,000 ways over, and all research has proven it as well. And I can quote Midrashim, quote me a Midrash which says it openly, Vayavidu et b'nei Yisrael b'perach. Men did maisa nashim, and nashim did had to do maisa gvarim. No, I asked the simple question that men do maisa nashim, that's not a punishment, I can understand it. But that women have to do maisa gvarim, that's a punishment. So anyway, I have a whole Devar Torah for a man that if you don't live up to your potential, Yomo, that is a punishment. When a man who has such ability winds up carrying a little package because a woman can't lift up a 100-pound package and a man can, that's a punishment that you're not using your talents. You follow me, Natan? But you see from the Medrash that men are men, women are women. And here at Peshel, I have to say, with all the criticism of him, I have to say, when he's talking about the feminist movement in general, look what they have accomplished. And many of them couldn't marry, couldn't sustain a marriage. Bella Hartzog, one by one. You look at the women in the Knesset, loud mouthed, shouting, powerful. Many of them divorced. I have to give credit to the new generation of women in the Knesset, whom I adore. I have to be honest with you. They have good marriages. They have fine children. Geveret Chotabeli, in class tomorrow, are two friends of us. Professor Paragon and Dr. Hexter are friends of the Chotabeli family. Saw the girl grow up. She wears a shaitel. She's proud to be married. She's a mother. Ayelet Shaked, no one's allowed to talk about her husband. He's in the Air Force, it seems. He's a pilot, but she's a respectable woman, Kanayin Hara. And other women, I don't want to give names, Gula Kohn, her husband, she said, no man can live with me, I'm too volatile. You understand? Then the Beseda, there are more names I can give, not important now. But here, I would mute Reb Heschel by saying, yes, there is influence in the feminist movement. Well, we don't want to be like the feminists. We don't want to reach an apex where a woman will say, I'm not bringing children into the world because it's a terrible world. Where will we Jews be tomorrow if women do not have children? And I'm proud to say that some of my own family, when they gave birth, with all that they accomplished academically, they said to me and Malka, this is our greatest achievement. I said, you're absolutely right. This is our tomorrow. Okay? We have to seek a balance here. Zelo pashut. It's not easy. And then he quotes the Rebbe. Here we come to the heart of today's Shavua. He quotes the Rav here, and in the Tshuva, Heschel has Yiddish, which Shimon will have no problem understanding. Vises kritzel sich, azeses yidet sich. Okay, and you understand that, and that is so true. Whatever happens, you don't understand it, Shai? Whatever happens in the Christian world ultimately happens in the Jewish world. And here, Rav Heschel listened to a whole discourse. You see, how did the Reform Movement begin? Reform Movement looked at the church and compared the church to the shtibbel. No, the church is beautiful, it's quiet, it's solid, it's decorous. Of course, the church, the whole service is under 1 hour. And that I can tell you from live experience. I grew up in a Catholic neighborhood. They went to Mass on Sunday. You know when the Masses were? 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. Every hour of Mass, they were home. If you went to 12 o'clock Mass, you were home by 10 to 1. Your mother brought out spaghetti and beer. The TV was on. The game of the week. That was their Sunday. So, I can't hear what you're saying.
Is it Italian or Irish?
Both. A third. A third Irish, a third Italian, a third Jewish. There was a big difference between the Irish and the Italian. The Italian families were much more respectable of each other. They respected women.
It wasn't so much anti-Semitism.
No, there was very little anti-Semitism. The Italians come up now. The Irish was Easter time. You had to be careful. You killed our God. But when they drank, oh boy, they were bad. They would smack their wives around. It was not pleasant. But Baruch Hashem, we survived. But we go to shul, of course. We go, this is why I have to tell you, in the rabbi, one of the first things I attempted to do was to make the service. I'm building an Orthodox shul, the first Orthodox. I mean, no one believes me today. First Orthodox shul, Essex County. Today it's filled with Orthodox Jews and shuls. Then there was nothing. And it was starting from scratch. And I remember I cut down the service so you could keep digging there. How did I cut it down? Very simple. No hosofat. I made one mishaberach at the end. I was told that Lubavitch, that's what the Rebbe did. Now, not always can I have my way, meaning you have to have seichel too. When some wealthy guy insists that he has yahrzeit and another guy with yahrzeit, so you may have to make a hosafa. But if you can cut the laning down to 25 minutes, it is wonderful. Again, with the Mishaberach, I once had an incident. You young rabbis, listen carefully. Where this wealthy guy, I don't want to mention it, a very well-to-do family. By the way, a family that essentially has remained Orthodox in America since the Civil War. A German family that came to America right after the Civil War, 1860s. And I know people living here, descendants of that family. I know descendants married to the Bersan family. Wow. So this wealthy guy, he wants to make me a mishaberach. So the gabbai looks at me, you know, I said, make him, you know, you psycho. The guy wants to give $36, which was heavy money in the early 60s. Don't stop because the rabbi introduced the rule. All right, make an exception. Life is filled with exceptions. So then they looked at the guy and went, what's beautiful? Go into a church. Ah, an organ. Why don't we have an organ? Then they looked at churches. It took longer. Why don't we have mixeding? And little by little, they innovated. And Rav Heschel goes into here, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Samach Aleph on Beit, there's a big sugya I learned with the Rav. In other words, if a Gentile who's ready to chop your head off tells you to bow down to an idol, so why can't you bow down? You don't believe in the idol. or a gentle tweeting you love, I don't know, someone you get along with, for the sake of argument. Many rabbis, when Obama was elected, they went to the cathedral in Washington. Remember what went on? Oh, the Orthodox rabbis, they loved a black man who's elected president of the United States, Shekhiyanu, Vikimanu, Vikiyanu, etc., etc. So why can't you bow down? So, all right, the Gemara goes into the whole sugya that it's not just belief. When you emulate Gentiles, you're destroying your own religion. And the Gemara goes so far, you all know this, the shoelace. Imagine if the goyim wear red shoelaces and Jews wear black, you're not allowed to change your shoelace to be like the goyim. So Reb Heschel takes the position, and I believe he's correct, that with all these innovations, we have to know where they're coming from. And we just can't innovate, we just can't alter the traditional service. The way we daven, the way we conduct ourselves in a Middash Ma'at. Alacha kama v'kama, when it's coming from aping, mimicking, the non-Jewish service. And here Reb Heschel quotes the Rav. And I'm going to give you some very, very interesting sources now that no one is going to have access to because these are very rare volumes. Maybe one day they'll be online. Check it out. Maybe a miracle has happened. Reb Heschel quotes the Rav, and he says the Rav was very extreme when it came to the Mechitza. The Rav changed his entire persona and fought like a lion and made very extreme comments. All right, a drop of background. What do we mean the Rav changed his persona? Let me explain to you. And by the way, this is my own research and I've published, but I'll very rarely say I'm absolutely right. What I'm telling you now, I'm not 90% right, I'm 99% right. Let me not say 100. Only HaKadosh Baruch Hu is 100% right. But I know what I have investigated here. The Rav came to the United States with dreams. It's what I spoke with Nathan about earlier today. The Rav came with the dream of being a shtat Rav like Reb Lezer Silva. He loved Reb Lezer Silva. Reb Lezer Silva was his model, was his role model, was his mentor, his first decade in the United States. The Rav went into the rabbinate, Boston area, and he had a lot of Achmas Nefesh. He was slammed around like a punching bag. You all know the story with the Birchat Kohanim, which is just indicative of what he went through. And he would tell the story time and again and laugh, and you could tell inside he was crying. He relived it. Came into a shul, all of you know, in Chutz Laretz, Birchat Kohanim is only on the festivals. Now what happens when the regalim fall on Shabbat? So I grew up, many people, no Birchat Kohanim, it's Chilul Shabbos. I mean, I'm a Haaretz. If you bless the people on a festival because it's a Zman of Simcha, Alacha Kama V'Kama when the festival falls on Shabbat. So the Rav is davening in one of these shuls in Boston, and you have to remember, Yomo, that you weren't a rabbi of a shul then. You were a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, who was a rabbi of a section of Boston. You were the Rav of this community. He's dominating one of the shuls, and he tells them they have to duchen on Shabbos. And they say, Rabbi Soloveitchik, what are you, an idiot, an amaretz, a boor? But uns duchen nicht. We don't duchen, chilul Shabbos. And the Rav started to yell, you have to duchen. All right, they duchen. After Shabbos, the board of directors came together, and they voted never to let the Rav daven with them again. The man is an apikairis and an amaretz and all that goes with it. So, again, and I'll say it in Yiddish and translate it, Nishke lekt honey. He didn't lick honey. in Boston in the 30s. Then there was the Kashrut scandal and the accusations, and you've seen the movie, you've read the Rav, you know what I'm talking about. It altered his personality. He kept away from any public posture or any public controversy. When I learned in Lakewood in the early 50s, all they did was maledict Chabad for being wasting time and putting tefillin on people on the streets, and they maledicted the Rav among their criticisms that he's not like Rav Aaron Cutler, he doesn't get involved, he doesn't yell, he doesn't shout. Ultimately, I learned they're absolutely right, and there are reasons why. Nevertheless, a number of incidents came along where the Rav became a public figure, where he felt ba'u mayim ad nefesh. There was no other way. The first incident where the Rav became a public figure, yelling, shouting, and writing extreme letters, concepts, statements, was the Mechitza issue. And here, I want to give you background, I want to give you insight. Reb Heschel quotes the Rav, and Reb Heschel was highly criticized that you're too extreme, but Reb Heschel got it from the Rav. When it comes to Kedushat Beit HaKnesset, the Rav was extreme. Gentlemen, I'm holding a Xerox copy of some pages from one of the most valuable volumes that I own. Moshe, I want to go back to 1969. When I came in Aliyah, I was a different Israel, and I learned very quickly I will never make a living in Israel being a Malamed. I worked for the encyclopedia at the end of 2 years when the encyclopedia came out and I was free to make a decision what to do. They offered me tremendous money to become a staff editor, kept the publishing, but I knew if I don't teach, I will not survive. So I made the decision to be a poor, struggling individual, but to do what I want. And among what I wanted was to master Kol HaTorah Kula, I told you that, to be a Tzaddik Yesod Olam. I never succeeded. I had another dream. Yitzchak, listen carefully. The old-timers who knew the Rav from Boston, who survived the Holocaust, all lived in Rehavia. I went to visit them one by one by one. Azriel Hildesheim came very close to him. David next to him. Zichrona Levracha. No. Who else? Who was Shah b'Memshelet Yisrael? Maftal?
Shulman Hammer?
Go back an earlier generation. Yosef Burg. Knew the Rav from Berlin. He was an amazing man, Yosef Burg. I was once standing around him with four different people, and as he looked at each one of us, he changed his language. To me, he spoke English, this guy French, this guy Spanish. I call him. I say, Kvot Hassav Burg, Pomadaber, Aron Rakefet. On the spot, he says to me, Atalo Aron Rakefet, Ata Aharon Rotkov. And I was bothered. I quote him in footnotes in the Rav. The most important person I met was Dr. Werner Zilberstein. Zilberstein, we would pronounce it in English. We became very friendly. And he was widowed at the time. But when he would go out to a very cultured, go out to a show, a movie, a symphony orchestra, he took a widow with him who was the mother of students of mine. So I knew him, number one, as someone from Berlin, and I knew him, you know, he loved me. I was a Talmud of the Rav, and I was the Rebbe of the woman that they didn't marry, but in friendship, they were two widowed people, so when they had to go out to a special affair, they would go together. I was the Rebbe of their children. I'm still very close to the family. Well, our beloved Uncle Werner, Professor Avraham David Shulbestein, died at the age of 101, February 1st, 2001. When he turned 95, the family published this memoir, My Way from Berlin to Jerusalem. He gave me three copies of the memoir. It was a family publication. One I gave to the Lichtenstein family, obviously, and the other one I gave to Rabbi Dr. Norman Glenn. I gave Normie a copy as well for yeshiva or for his personal use. This is a very fascinating memoir. I can't quote everything. He knew the Rav as a youngster in Berlin. He describes the scene any Friday night. They're davening in the shtibel in Berlin, a shul that he loved, though he was a Yekut Tahar, but there were a lot of Jews from Poland who had come to Berlin after World War I, and I think they called them Auschwitz. They weren't really German Jews. And one Friday night, must be 26, a Jew comes over to him and the shtibel says, Werner, turn around and look. What are you seeing back at you? I see a tall teenager. That man will be the greatest rabbi in the coming generation. Werner looks like a clean-shaven, tall kid. What are you talking about? That is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's grandson, and they say he has the mind of his grandfather. And he describes Berlin. He describes the Rav in Berlin. He describes Rav Hugh Yaakov Weinberg, Rav Chaim Hella. Wow. He invites the Rav to his Seder. And he describes the Rav coming to the house. I mean, Donnie, do you appreciate what I'm saying to you? This is a live description of the Rav, 1926, 1927. How the Rav is coming and he's checking with his wife, Raya, how she kashered the oven, what she did. And evidently the Rav was pleased because later that day we got a big bouquet of flowers were delivered before the Seder from the Rav. And he came to the Seder in their house. Now, this young teenager, it's a beautiful, beautiful document. To me, it's overwhelming. Now, this young man gets a doctorate. He was in public medicine, public health. And later in Jerusalem, he was head of the public health in the Misrat HaBriyut of Yerushalayim and the area. And Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi becomes his Rebbe. And then he gets a problem that he's getting a position and he's doing research in the Medical Diagnostic Institute in Koblenz. And he said to the Rav, wasn't the Rav yet, he was a youngster, he says to my Rebbe, I have to be there, and I checked out. There's only a big liberal synagogue. Where can I daven? Where can I hear the shofar? I asked my friend J.D. Soloveitchik. J.D. is Yosef Dov. Afterwards, until his passing, I'm quoting from page 52, the spiritual leader on the authority of Orthodox Jewry of the Lithuanian tradition in the United States, quote, what am I going to do in Rosh Hashanah in Koblenz? The problem of meals have been solved for Raya and myself by Mrs. Bundy, a strictly observant woman in Koblenz. Do you recognize the name? The Bundy family. It's a well-known German Orthodox family.
Were they related to the Rav Watching Heights?
Yeah, they're related to Breuer, correct.
Yeah,
right. So Soloveitchik told me, quote, if you cannot find a perfectly acceptable minion, you will have to attend the Musaf service at the local synagogue, since especially according to the Rambam, One is only Yotzei with Chazaretz HaShavs on Musaf Rosh Hashanah. Could you imagine? This is a psak from the Rav. Now, what is he talking about? No, gentlemen, have you ever studied the Mishnayot and Rosh Hashanah, the Sugya? The Musaf on Rosh Hashanah could be Me'ikar HaDin. You don't even have to daven it as an individual. You have to listen to the Chazaretz HaShatz to be Yotzei. That Musaf, again, I don't know how long it takes you to daven. It takes me well over a half hour, and I cry like a baby in some of those psukim. But that Musaf, who knew how to daven it? Who had a text for it? Remember, you're talking at a time when printing was not like today. So it could be the whole institution was betzibur, not beyechidat. No? If that's the case, this is with lamdas. The Rav tells him, it's not only you have to hear shofar. On Rosh Hashanah, you must daven with a minyan so that your yotzei tfilat musaf. No. Look what the Rav is pashkening. Michael, this is a liberal synagogue. All right, maybe it's not reform yet, but it's certainly not orthodox. It certainly has mixed seating. And this is what the Rav pashkened for him. Eidut Nemana, written Meshich Lefi Tumo. Hold on. Don't ask a thing yet. Now, he adds on a rejoinder, a qualification. It's difficult to imagine that later he would have arrived at the same decision where the fight against conservative reformed temples in the United States is stronger than ever. But this is what he paskened for me back in the 1920s. Now, it turns out that I had no need to make use of his decision, because not far from Koblenz in Volendar, incidentally the birthplace of Goethe's mother, we found a small, strictly Orthodox rural community where we spent the high holy days. Gentlemen, what a document. What a psak of the Rav. What a difference.
What year was that?
It doesn't give the year, but I would estimate 27, 28. What a difference from Reb Heschel.
What a difference of salvation.
What a difference. You took the words out of my mouth. What a difference from the Rav. Ke pasa. What happened? If you recall, a few weeks ago, we had a guest who was visiting Israel, a young man, Uri Jacobs, lives in Teaneck, I believe. He's been my Talmud many years via the internet. If you recall, I spoke in class about his grandfather, Harold Jacobs. Wonderful individual. Torah Vadas graduate, the man who fought for orthodoxy before it was fashionable. A wealthy businessman with impeccable business credentials, honest, did wonders in his lifetime. Young Israel, OU, Torah Mesorah. Uri gave me a gift, which I thank him for. I made a copy for Yitzhak. Yitzhak passed this back. Yitzhak was in the rabbinate. He'll appreciate. Here's the volume. The Life and Legacy of Harold M. Jacobs. Building Orthodox Judaism in America. It's a very good picture, but that's just the way he looked. Just the way I remember him. Go to page 95. And he summarizes everything I would want to tell you. It's all here. Gentlemen, in the United States of America, it wasn't developed here, it becomes as a result of the Enlightenment. You always have it in France and Germany in the 1800s. Sociologists, political scientists, their role is to analyze society and to make predictions. 60, 70 years ago, quite a few books came out on Judaism in the United States. It was a period after the Holocaust, the refugees had invaded America, and everyone was interested, what is happening here? Before World War II, Reform conquered the United States. After World War II, the future never looked more beautiful than the future of the conservative movement. Those of you who have heard my lectures years ago, decades ago, I don't remember when, maybe someday someone will do an index to everything that's on the website, on the YU Torah website from a guy named Rakefet, it'll be easier to find. I gave detailed lectures. What made conservative Judaism so attractive? See, in World War II, America had one concept, the melting pot. You gotta become an American. It's what they're trying to do in Europe today with the Muslim immigrants. They want them to sign a pledge that they will believe in the ideals of Western Europe. So you can imagine how many terrorists among them will sign the pledge. Some sign gesund. It's like when Israel released thousands of murderers and they signed the pledge not to murder again. It didn't even take 24 hours and they were back in the business of murdering men, women, and children of Jewish origins. After World War II, another concept became important in the United States. Ethnic origins, minorities. Black is beautiful. And we're not to be ashamed of where we come from, the language we speak, where we grew up. It's all part of the mosaic of the vast, powerful United States of America. Now, let's look at
World War II.
Excuse me?
It was a long time after World War II.
Well, by the mid-50s. No, they're already discussing it in the 50s because... Well, yeah, but you got to remember, the conservative movement by the mid-50s, that was the dream. Every YU graduate had to play with the concept, should I continue in REITs? Or should I go to JTS, where the great tomorrow was being formed? My dear students, Reform Judaism was too melting pot. Everything's in English. There's an organ. Very little Hebrew. Orthodoxy, ethnic origins. That's the past. Left it in Europe. Conservative Judaism, the absolute perfect blend, synthesis, balance between the melting pot and ethnic origins. Giddy, that was America at that time.
Reform didn't reach out to the...
Relax. I don't want to argue. I want to court. I have to go on. Michael, we can discuss it, but essentially I'm not wrong in what I'm saying. I may not have the exact date, but...
I grew up in that world.
I rabbinated in that world, and I saw half my classmates...
There was no reform in Northeast Philadelphia.
It was all conservative.
Totally.
All conservative.
No one knew from reform.
So watch. Look what these three great scientific scholars, one wasn't Jewish, two were, these are political scientists, sociologists, Will Herbergs, Protestant Catholic Jew, 1955, Marshall Sklar's Conservative Judaism, 1955, Nathan Glaser's American Judaism, 1957. All three volumes said exactly the same thing. The Orthodox Jew will disappear. He has no future in the United States. And they explained it. Orthodoxy could survive only in congested urban areas where the bulk of European immigrants had initially settled, such as New York City's Lower East Side, or in Philadelphia, Strawberry Mansion, South Philly. In such settings, the immigrants' poverty, lack of sophistication, and habitual resort to familiar old world ways helped preserve an attachment to Orthodoxy, or at least to a shell of ritual observance and traditional beliefs. But as subsequent generations moved out to secondary areas of settlement, such as Brooklyn, Queens, beyond that, Long Island, Westchester, northern New Jersey, the combination of changed socioeconomic circumstances and the absence of the ethnic flavors and rhythms of the old neighborhood would spell doom for Orthodoxy. The quote from Sklar, Marshall Sklar, the rate of acculturation depends on the tempo of social mobility. As Jews climbed the socioeconomic ladder and advanced into American culture and society, they would abandon traditional religious practices. The Orthodox community would be left with only the elderly, the socially immobile, and the tiny, stubborn handful of unassimilated diehards. Orthodoxy, by its nature, was impervious to change, according to Sklar. Quote, if Orthodoxy had retained the ability to change, it would have evolved into conservatism. And he goes on in this chapter. It's a fabulous chapter of what the American Jewish religious scene was like in the mid-1950s. Gentlemen, now you can understand why the Rav left the classroom, left his study, changed his entire temperament. And I don't think it was easy for the Rav, because I know firsthand how much he suffered in Boston and what the Kashrut scandal did to him. It hurt him. He came home. Again, I don't know if I should even talk about it, but let me get it out of my system. I heard this from my witnesses. He came home distraught how people could lie. Understand, the Rav came from a world kulo Torah. He came from a world, you know what I told you more than once, that we always joke around when I get together with Talmidim of the Rav, they all laugh, we all say and agree that for Rebbe, if you ate Yom Kippur, it wasn't as bad as showing intellectual dishonesty. You follow? And here he would come home, and rabbis lie. Now I can tell you in parentheses, one of the biggest rabbanim who campaigned against him in the Kashrut scandal and lied, years later, the Rav saved him from going to jail. Now you should be aware of it, who the Rav was. He was in tax evasion, the real McCoy. And the Rav used his influence, which he had at that time, saved him from indictment, which would have resulted in a jail sentence, not just a civil penalty. The Rav went public, and he went public loud and clear. And he too, now quoting from Sanctity of the Synagogue, and Reb Heschel posts this, and Reb Heschel is very strong, but those who criticize Reb Heschel have to criticize the Rav. He's getting this from the Rav, and you have to understand why. It's not 1925 in Berlin, it's 1955 in Boston. What a different world. And the Rav quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin 74b, Ayin Dalet Amid Bet, where the Gemara speaks about shoelaces. And the Rav says, we are living at a time requiring of us a heroic stand in times of adversary. And then he says something else. It's not just if a guy asks you to change your shoelaces, even if a Jew asks you to change your shoelaces, applies not only to political and religious persecution originated by some pagan ruler, but also the situations in which a small number of God-fearing and Torah-loyal Jewish people are confronted with a hostile attitude on the part of the majority, dominated by a false philosophy. And wow, the Rav here is unbelievably strong. Now what you're dealing with here, and I'll give you another quote from him in a moment, you're dealing here with one of the most basic problems of democracy. And this is a problem when it's called to your attention, and it should be called to your attention, even in kindergarten already, it's crucial to understand this, to come out of life a decent Torah Jew. Now what am I talking about? Very simple. Donny Kaplan was in kindergarten, and it was a beautiful, beautiful spring day like we have today, and the teacher said to the class, oh, this is a beautiful day. Should we go and play in the park, or should we go to the library and look at the new books? And she put it to a vote. And 23 kindergarten kids voted to play in the park. And one kid, Donnie Kaplan, voted to go to the library. You with me, Shimon? Oh boy, the kids made fun of him. He suffers until today. They laugh at him. Giddy? This is a problem of democracy. Michael Miller grew up in a world. Who was Shimon Shabbos? By the way, Rafi comes from the same neighborhood, the same area, the same world. His father's a Rav. Northeast, right?
Yeah.
Talking about the Northeast. I grew up in a world. Who was Shimon Shabbos? The only two men I knew who were Shimon Shabbos who were above the age of 21 and under the age of 70 were the Kapinski brothers. One of the Kabonot killed in Hanof, Aryeh Kapinski, Hashem Yikom Damo. That's a grandson of Elia Kapinski. Who was Shimon Shabbos? Shavuos, who knew there was a Shavuos in the world? Pesach is good, it falls next to Easter.
Confirmation.
Sukkot is good, it comes after Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Shavuot? Who went to Shul? Who knew? Who what? And you went to shul, went with the minyanim, we spoke about it, 6:30 in the morning, Shabbos morning, Yom Tov morning, everyone davened, said Kaddish, went home, ate breakfast, changed to their work clothes, and went to work. What are we talking about? God have mercy. You don't start to realize the miracle of the rebirth of Torah. You don't understand. I cry, or I can't help myself. Whenever I speak about Balei Tshuva, I cry. Because I was raised in a world, people were running and running and running away. Not, I have to admit, I'm a frum kid. From the age of 12, 11 on, I was a totally frum kid. But that has to do with simple sugihara. You have to understand, my background, I had the advantage of both a BT, and what's the other one? An FFB. I have both within. I've spoken about it. It's not for now. I've analyzed it. But I can understand. I have the advantage of both. Both worlds have a big advantage. In other words, I am what I am because I chose. No one forced me. On the other hand, I didn't have to destroy a world and build a new world. My entire world was always Torah. Semper Sugihara. Gentlemen, the Rav made the point, don't be overwhelmed. The conservatives are such a big majority. Their temples are filled. They ride the shul on Shabbos. Drive the shul. Their membership is filled. Have it your way. Simon Greenberg. Simon Greenberg said to me, you know what he told me? He said, it's not just that we permitted driving to shul on Shabbos. The tragedy, that's not the tragedy for us. The tragedy is that even after we permitted it, if there's no bar mitzvah or no confirmation, no one comes to the temple. And so you're going to feel second rate. And he says, we must remember that an ethical or halachic principle decreed by God is not rendered void by the fact that the people refuse to abide by it. Its cogency and veracity are perennial and independent of compliance on the part of the multitudes. And here the Rav says something very strong. If the ethical norm, thou shalt not kill, has not lost its validity during the days of extermination camps and gas chambers when millions of people were engaged in ruthless murder, but on the contrary, has been impregnated with deeper meaning and significance than every halachic maxim assumes greater import in times of widespread disregard and unconcern. The greater the difficulty, the more biting the ridicule and sarcasm, and the more numerous the opponent, then the holier is the principle, and the more sacred is our duty to defend it. And the Rav here, very powerfully, it's not just when a goy forces you. Even when the majority of Jews are mechalel Shabbos, ochlein nevelet and treifat, boel bilot asurat, it doesn't change the Torah. Democracy has its limits. My dear students, what the Rav is touching upon here, these are problems that we live with until this very day. You're dealing here in the State of Israel, the Supreme Court, conversion, the Kotel, the Southern Wall, the Western Wall. These are problems that we deal with every day. The army, the beards, the lack of beards, what's going on today? Wow. Who do you listen to? The fear on the highest level in the army. God have mercy if the rabbis take over. What are we raising here? Officers who listen to their rabbis or listen to the chief of staff? You follow the problems? These are on the floor, on the table, right now. And the Rav here, very sharp, very revolutionary. Even if a Jew tells you, change your shoelaces from black to red, chas v'chalila, we cannot do it. Change the shoe, mix seating? Wow. Innovate in the synagogue? Heschel Rav Schechter is quoting the Rav. Word by word. Finally, and you all know that by the 1950s, there was a temple in Brookline that decided to go conservative and take down its mechitza and have mixed seating.
The
K.I.? K.I., I believe it was called, yes.
Yeah, K.I.
And that's the synagogue where the Rav's brother-in-law died. That's the synagogue. And the Rav's brother-in-law, I believe it was Meiselman, maybe you can correct me which one it was of the two brothers-in-law.
His son is a lawyer here in Shabbat.
Gerber. Oh, it's the other one, Gerber.
Gerber.
Yeah, Gerber lives on my street. I know him very well.
Louis.
You and he, of course, Eliezer Gerber, Louis Gerber. It's his father. asked the Rav, where do I daven? And the Rav told him, Rosh Hashanah, you stay at home and you don't clear shofar. And the Rav went with Lumdus, that where there's mixed seating, this synagogue forfeits its sanctity, and you can't be Yotzei davening or shofar in such a makom of tiflut, not of tefillah. So we have come full cycle. We have more to do next week, Be'ezrat Hashem. Yitzchak, I am ready.
The talk that the Rav gave to social workers, which is on the internet.
Right.
He has...
You know who saved that talk for the world? A guy with a crooked nose staring at you at this moment in time.
So you
owe me a thank you.
He has a psychological, sociological interpretation of the whole thing of the pizza. Not halacha. He's talking about the fact that when a person comes to daven to God, he is supposed to not feel comfortable.
Right.
He has to have trepidation. Right. He has to have yira, not mechpacha. And therefore, if he's sitting next to his wife and his children, he feels comfortable.
And
they are his sponsors. They are his supporters.
And he thinks they can save him and sustain him.
Well, sitting next to his buddies talking about
baseball. No, but this is very fascinating.
Right.
They love to use this
right.
as one of the reasons why.
We have separate seats. And if you go back to Sanctity of the Synagogue, you'll find it in there in his testimony, in his deposition. You'll find that concept, which he later used many, many times. Gentlemen, we have not yet finished Reb Heschel. We have a world yet to do beyond Reb Heschel, and we're going to come back to the Rav again in great detail in a number of weeks' time. Be'ezrat Hanotein L'Yov Kolach. But I will testify for myself, and I will say Yitzchak will agree with me that both of us have to kiss the stupidity of the people in Tel Aviv that they didn't elect the Rav chief rabbi in 1935. Had he been elected here, there's no question he would have developed into a second Rav Kook. It's like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, elected in 51, and who he developed into. Thank God they didn't elect him, so it gave me the chance to grow up on his lap and to become a big Zionist, and today be angry at anyone who stays in America, you understand? We've come full cycle. All right, it's been a fascinating lecture today. Tomorrow is even more fascinating. And I want to tell the people listening across the world, I'm aware of the difficulty of last Monday's lecture. I hope I'll be told tomorrow morning that today's tape came out perfect. And I'll redo some of the highlights of last week and then sail into what I want to accomplish. Now, I want to...
From last Monday?
Did not come out.
Yeah, I didn't.
Did not come out well. And I got a lot of feedback when I spoke with San Francisco this morning, and even there they hit me over the head. They think I'm responsible. What can I do? Ich bin nur ein Mensch, and I'm a yachid here. It's not that YU gives me a supply system.
I wrote on the website next to the shear, it's completely my fault.
Yomo, relax. Gentlemen, relax. These are two the same. It's the last issue of this series. It's by a YU product by Aryeh Strakovsky. He's evidently retiring. I hope he's in good health. He's a little younger than I am. Yitzchak, are you in touch with him yet?
No, but we work together.
I know, but he's retiring. This is the last issue. It's on Romanian Jewry. And in here you'll find a nice piece around Sicilian. Anyone who's interested in what can come out of the shear that you're in, this is a piece written up in the latest Torah to Go, which was not published. It's online on something I said in class many years ago, and a young lady, a very fine lady, Eliana Sohn, writes it up very, very nicely. This is a fascinating article, New York Times, as the Sabbath nears in Israel, soccer becomes a test of faith. And it's about the big problem of soccer games on Shabbos when some of the real stars of soccer don't want to play on Shabbos. New York Times writes it up very nicely. This is about a Jewish museum of baseball and I thank those who sent it to me, and you can get it on a website, and wow, it's like a dream come true. This is for Yomo. It's a Yomo, please, Avraham, where is he? This is about a Fabrengen in Germany. What's he doing in Germany?
He's
what? He's what? He's going. Oh, a day. I thought he's going to Karev Yehudim. All right, good. Shirich Dirk in Germany. Very nice. Very nice. This is about a Fabrengen in Russia. It's online from the in Russian. Under the Communist Chabad. I recognize some of the people in it, and it's in the Shtibel in Arkhipova Street. It is very, very moving. Even those of you who don't know Russian, it's Yiddish, Russian, and a kid begins playing the violin, the Alter Rebbe's Niggun. It's beautiful. This is for you. Okay? Help anyone who wants to get to it. This is a fabulous article on Orthodox kids who used to make a living at Wrigley Field, and the shyless, they would sell drinks and to the peanuts and ice cream, the shyless they would ask, and how it's going the way of Cub Wins. It's not worth it anymore for them to do the job. But a very fascinating article. I don't know where it's from, but it's, I think, this is an article on Welch and Kedem being fought right now. It seems Welch has a whole line that's kosher to Pesach. So they're going crazy. All I can tell you is...
They've been kosher for a while. It's now
a couple
able
years
to
ago.
Be made Kiddush.
It's been a couple of years
now. No,
what?
Now they're
what?
Making so that you can make
Kiddush. And at 1 second, it has a good... Believe me, Welch is going to have a good head shot. I just want to tell you what I told someone in Hollywood, Florida today. Israel is the only place in the world where the prices of food are much cheaper for Pesach. You should see the wars going on between the stores. What I brought home today, 8 bottles of Pepsi Max, big bottles, under $1 a bottle, 8 for the price of 6, and the 6 is Rami Levy. You can't do better. What a place to live.
Yeah, but
I'm an
Israeli salary. It's just as expensive.
Moshe, don't criticize Israel when we stand a few weeks before Yom HaAtzmaut. Gentlemen, here's how Coca-Cola became kosher and changed the industry for Rabbi Geffen.
Rabbi Geffen and
yeah.
Rabbi Georgia.
And here's a very interesting tshuva from the Eimek Halakha. This is from Rabbi Lamb's great uncle, I believe it is, or grandfather. It may be his mother's grandfather. Yeah, father, I don't know, has to be checked. Eimek Halakha by Rabbi Baumel. A guy who made a neder when his son went overseas in World War II. If my son returns shalom, intact, I will make a heavy donation to tzedakah. And the kid comes back intact, married to a goya he met in Italy. Does he have to make the donation to tzedakah? And finally, for fear that they didn't hear it around the world. Once again, I want to end off the class. I'm the happiest kid alive. My dear friend Barry Liebman, the biggest publisher of stamps in the world for analphabetic countries, just did a whole series for Granada on Sefer Sugihara. So you'll say in Granada, did they know who he is? No, of course not, but it's a legal stamp there. But it's sold all over the world. Anyone who serves stamps about World War II, stamps about Japan, stamps about the Holocaust, stamps about Jews.
Why did they have that in Japan?
Will have to, because Japan publishes its own stamps. These are all simple Sugihara stamps. Blocks, different pictures of him, different portraits, all based upon life portraits. And here he is with his wife, whom we yet met here in this, we brought her here when we had a big dinner for the missing in action of 1980.
You know, he can do marketing by giving this to the Japanese.
Whatever, he knows how to market. But I'm letting everyone know, if you're interested, I guess you have to go to the computer and through Semple Sugihara, you'll find out about the stamps. I've changed my stationery. I have to get rid of the old. This stamp is now on the corner of my stationery under Toru Mader. I told Sherry I can't erase Toru Mader. Why? You will fire me. But I can add on Senpo Sugihara with this beautiful quote, one man can make a difference. Gentlemen, I wouldn't miss the shiur tomorrow morning at 9:05.
You're going to just repeat everything just because they yeah. take then come out?
I won't read,
what about the people here? You have to hear it twice.
Rabbi, no, you won't have to hear it twice. I give the highlights. Instead of 2 minutes, it'll take 5 minutes. No, it's not going to be 20 minutes. I'm going to lead right into tomorrow's shiur. Don't worry about it. Until we meet again in health and happiness, thus for Danya.